Discussions of the civil rights struggle in our country tend to be regional, and the region examined is often the South. When we talk about the big events leading up to civil rights legislation 50 years ago, the cities mentioned are places like Selma and Birmingham and Montgomery. But today we'll talk about Boston and Springfield and Brooklyn, among other places, because those are the places historian Jason Sokol focuses upon in his book, All Eyes Are Upon Us: Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn, the Conflicted Soul of the Northeast. Jason Sokol is an assistant professor at the University of New Hampshire. His earlier book is There Goes My Everything, White Southerners in the Age of Civil Rights. Jason, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having me.
Did the research into that earlier book lead you naturally to this one?
Well, I'm originally from Massachusetts, so I think in a way I've always been puzzling through race in the North my whole life, although in my first book, I wanted to go to where what I thought the heart of the civil rights struggle, the South, but in a way, I always knew what my second project would be.
This is something that I think surprises some people, and having grown up in New York and Connecticut myself, I tell people that things are often felt as strongly there as they are in the South, just expressed somewhat differently. So it didn't surprise me particularly, but I imagine you get a few people whose jaws drop when you explain what happened in the North.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, in the popular mind, there is still a belief, a pretty powerful belief, that race and segregation and Jim Crow, that those things are really Southern things. Now, a lot of my colleagues in, you know, professors, history professors, have gone pretty far in the other direction, painting the North as a land of segregation and racism. And my book's really about the war between those two traditions in the North. On the one hand, the striving for freedom, and on the other hand, the realities of segregation and racism.
All right, let's start with an easy fact, or a set of them. Jackie Robinson breaking the color barrier in baseball, becoming the first African-American Major League Baseball player in 1947. But what sorts of situations did he find trying to find housing in Brooklyn?
Jackie Robinson and his wife, Rachel Robinson, they experienced firsthand, they experienced the housing discrimination that was endemic to many parts of the Northeast. When they first tried to rent apartments in various parts of Brooklyn, some of the white homeowners on those blocks passed around petitions, not wanting to have the homes nearby occupied by African Americans. And that was only a precursor to what their real struggle was when they attempted to find a home in the white suburbs of Connecticut and Westchester County, New York, which is, and so when the Robinsons attempted to do that in the early 50s, they were given the runaround everywhere they went, and it took them several years to actually buy a home. And, you know, what's always amazing to me is that this is not an anonymous African-American trying to buy a home in the white suburbs. It's Jackie Robinson, the most famous, one of the most famous people in the country at the time.
Yeah, and even so, I mean, his fame was not able to overcome this resistance to the fact that his skin color dictated that he should live in one part of town separate from where the white folks lived.
Yeah, there was this, what it was a self-fulfilling prophecy where white suburbanites, and not only suburbanites, but white homeowners thought that if one African-American bought a house on the block or in the neighborhood or even in the town, they thought that the property values would plummet. And there was nothing true about that unless they themselves began to deflate the value of their own homes by the fact of their towns being integrated. So Robinson couldn't overcome that barrier. You know, their realtor steered them to certain towns and neighborhoods. They would offer the asking price on a property, and then there would be a period of silence, and they would be told that the price was increased by $5,000. So the Robinsons increased their bid, and then they were told it was taken off the market. All sorts of obstacles and barriers and obfuscations that you could think of.
Right in the introduction of All Eyes Are Upon Us, you write of Edward Brooke, the African-American elected to the Senate from Massachusetts in 1966, but within a paragraph or two, write also of Boston's ongoing reputation in the African-American community, which is it still that way?
Well, I think for a long time, Boston has been thought of as a racist city by African-Americans. you know, when you first talked about the fact that many people would be surprised to hear that it was the North that I studied, those people would be white people. African Americans in the country are not surprised to hear about Northern racism or Northern segregation. That's something they've been dealing with all their lives and something that's been well known in the black community.
We should mention right now, of course, the explosion in Boston with the busing that was meant to integrate Boston schools in the 1970s. That was one of my introductions as a New Englander at that time, living in Connecticut, just one state away, that people really, really felt strongly about not having the schools integrated, the white folks in South Boston.
That's right. I mean, when people think of race and Boston in the 1960s and 70s, what they think of is this anti-busing violence. And there's the very famous photo of white anti-busing protesters using an American flag as their weapon, as they, in effect, were striking an African-American with that American flag in the middle of downtown Boston in 1976, just as Boston was celebrating the bicentennial of the nation's founding. So there you had quite a striking image of the racism that existed in the supposed cradle of liberty.
And that would be Boston. Jason Sokol's book is All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn. He visited in January 2015. You'll hear the rest of the interview shortly here on the Jefferson Exchange, back here on the program in a minute 25. On the Jefferson Exchange, on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Historian Jason Sokol of the University of New Hampshire has written three books about the civil rights movement and its leaders. For the middle one, he departed from the well-worn trail and focused on how the North adapted to integration. And the answer is, not as well as you might have thought. The book is All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn. Jason Sokol visited 3 years ago, and we go back to that interview now. So we just touched on the Boston busing situation in the 70s. Let's move 100 miles west and 35 years back in time and talk about the Springfield Plan in Springfield, Massachusetts. What was that?
The Springfield Plan was, this was a program that the city of Springfield, Massachusetts implemented at the beginning of World War II, and it was a program that the leaders of the city and the leaders of the school system said would be designed to abolish prejudice from that city, abolish racial and religious and ethnic prejudice. And this was a city of about 150,000 people. It had a significant but small African-American population, and it had a mix of ethnicities and religions. And this was World War II time, you know, the fight against Nazi Germany. And many people in America, at least in the Northeast, were thinking about how they could rid their own communities of the kind of scourge that was seen taking overtaking Europe.
So the idea being that, you know, this is, we don't want what Hitler is doing to the Jews to happen to minorities in this country. Was it ever stated that boldly in parallel?
It actually was usually stated that boldly, or at least it was stated that was the inspiration, you know, that America realized that it was fighting a war against racial hatred abroad. And so Northeasterners, at least, pictured themselves as, in a way, the last best hope of the earth. You had vicious anti-Semitism in Europe and Germany, and then you also had vicious segregation and racism below the Mason-Dixon line. So you had these leaders in the Northeast thinking of themselves as sort of a model not only for the nation but also for the world. And so the idea would be in Springfield, the idea was to teach tolerance in classrooms, to teach a sort of multicultural and pluralistic curriculum, and that hoping that thereby you would raise Americans who were free from this racial prejudice.
And yet at the same time, you had psychologist Kenneth Clark doing some work in Springfield with dolls of various shades. Tell us about that.
Well, Kenneth Clark was a black psychologist who gained fame during the Brown versus Board case of 1954, where he testified about his doll tests. In fact, he had been doing his doll tests in schools of the South as well as schools of the North. And what he was trying to do was trying to study the effects of racial prejudice on young African-American children. So he would bring children into the testing room, young black children, and he would have two different dolls, a brown doll and a white doll, and he would ask the child a list of questions, show me the doll that looks pretty, show me the doll that you would like to be, questions along those lines. And invariably, a huge percentage of the black children associated the white doll with all of the positive characteristics. And what Clark concluded was that at a very young age, these children had already internalized and absorbed feelings of racial inferiority. And that he actually found that in the Springfield schools in the North, a higher percentage of the children associated those white dolls with the positive characteristics. So at the same time that the leaders of Springfield were trying to make their city a place free of prejudice, Kenneth Clark's experiments were showing that, many black children already internalized that message of prejudice.
Historian Jason Sokol is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book on racism in the Northeast is All Eyes Are Upon Us. So I have to believe that the folks who are trying to implement the Springfield Plan became aware of the Kenneth Clark research.
I'm not aware that they did. Because Clark did his experiments in 1939, and that was right about the year that the superintendent of schools, John Granrud, was hatching his plan, and then the plan wasn't really implemented until 1940-41. So I'm not sure that there was that kind of awareness. There was, and to a degree, it shows the disconnect that characterized a lot of white progressive leaders, which is that they weren't necessarily really aware or attuned to what was going on in the black community, even as they hatched and designed these sort of grand-sounding plans to rid their city of prejudice, because those plans were really focused on white minds and white hearts and trying to rid those of prejudice without a real commitment to improving the employment or living conditions of the African American community.
And so clearly a lot of pride from the people who are connected to the Springfield Plan, and apparently a lot of articles, books, and even a movie about it. Was it ever really as effective as a lot of the coverage portrayed it to be?
I don't think it was totally effective. It certainly didn't rid the city of prejudice. The plan was scuttled in 1945 when the war ended and a conservative administration took power in Springfield, and sort of, the World War II time pressed Americans urgently together. People who would otherwise have been fragmented or divided, they sort of got together in this fight against Nazism. And once the war was over, it was as though the balloon sort of lost its air. And I think that in many ways is what happened in Springfield. Although, one qualifier is that it's important that the experiment was tried at all. It certainly wasn't being tried in the South. It certainly wasn't being tried in Mississippi or Alabama. Leaders there thought that this was some sort of scheme for miscegenation. So I think relative to what was going on in other parts of the country in the early 40s, it was a sort of revolutionary idea. though you have to say that it certainly didn't achieve what it set out to.
So there is this sense again then that when we were pulling together to fight the great battle against the scourge of Nazi Germany and the Japanese Empire, that we had things like women working in jobs that were traditionally reserved for men. We had some level of participation in a lot of things where African Americans had not traditionally been allowed to go. But basically, when the war ended, it was sort of like, well, let's get back to the way we were.
You know, it was like that in a lot of places. I mean, I found in my first book that white Southerners came back from the war, and what they wanted to do was make sure that Jim Crow was still standing tall in the South. So they didn't believe that they had fought a war to sort of free America of racism. And, you know, you found a similar desire among many veterans in the North to just get back to life how it was and to not forge any great experiment in interracial democracy. And then, of course, 1947, Jackie Robinson came along, and he was also a veteran. So you have to say also that for African Americans, especially those who fought in the war, they did come back with a new sense that they were entitled as ever to the freedom and equality and democracy that America claimed it was fighting for.
Jason Sokol is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, historian, assistant professor of history at the University of New Hampshire, and the author of a book about race relations in the northeastern United States, All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn, The Conflicted Soul of the Northeast. There are a number of wow moments, and the book is really full of them, I suppose you could say. But the Massachusetts legislature did debate a statewide version of the Springfield Plan, and it sounds like the debate got ugly.
The debate did get ugly. That was in, this was in 1946, so it was at the war had ended, and the Springfield Plan itself had ended in Springfield, and there was a debate in Boston on Beacon Hill, and one legislator from the Boston area stood up and he opposed this idea of a statewide Springfield plan, and in doing so he slung the most vulgar racial epithet, and the legislators in Beacon Hill were horrified. They were ashamed. This wasn't what happened in Boston, they said. This would be a scene that one would see in Jackson, Mississippi, or in Montgomery in Alabama, but not in the great State House on Beacon Hill, they claim.
Wow. All right. So now from Springfield back to Brooklyn, we did talk about Jackie Robinson earlier. I want to get into that a little more in depth here. It seems like that once Jackie Robinson was able to join the Brooklyn Dodgers in 1947, that there was a fair amount of self-congratulation within Brooklyn. Was there anybody really working for equality and things like housing at that time within Brooklyn itself?
Well, yes, there were people working for housing in Brooklyn. Brooklyn was an incubator of many social movements, many political reform movements. So you had people on the political left and also in civil rights organizations who were working for fair housing and who were working for fair employment laws. But they weren't necessarily getting very far with the vast majority of white Brooklynites. And so the other major thing going on during World War II in terms of race relations was the Second Great Migration, chronicled by Isabel Wilkerson and others. And this is when millions of African Americans came up to northern cities and went out to western cities and midwestern cities. And invariably, they were corralled into certain sections of the city. In Brooklyn, it was Bedford-Stuyvesant. That's where the African American migrants could find housing, really the only place they could find housing, and much of the housing was in bad shape. A lot of the grocery stores charged higher prices. So the irony that I found is that story was going on at the exact same time that Robinson was integrating baseball and that fans were huddling in Ebbets Field and rooting for Robinson and thus proclaiming that Brooklyn was forging this great breakthrough in terms of interracial democracy. So the two stories were both very real, and they were going on at the same time.
I should point out the book is illustrated with photographs, and one of the more compelling ones is a picture of Brooklyn Dodger fans very excited about their team when it, I mean, because it was a great team from 1947 until its departure in 1957. Hard to believe it was just 10 years there from Jackie Robinson's arrival to the whole team's departure. But one of the pictures is of all these fans celebrating in all different colors, but then you become aware as you move away from the picture and back into the text that they went home to very, very different places. And in fact, you point out Bed-Stuy actually held more African Americans than Harlem at its peak.
Yeah, it did. I mean, this is this was the result of the second Great Migration, which was that, you know, Harlem was a relatively small area geographically, and it could hold only so many people. So when that neighborhood, you know, spilled over, a lot of people simply moved down to Brooklyn from Harlem, and at the same time, they moved up from the South. And so the New York Times called Bed-Stuy the largest, quote-unquote, Negro area in the country during the 1950s. So, yeah, its population surpassed that of Harlem, and it was sort of the heart of African-American life in the North.
All right, so the war's over in 1945. Jackie Robinson joins the Dodgers in 1947. How long until laws banning housing discrimination were passed within New York City?
Well, the legislature came up with a law in 1955, and this was the Baker-Metcalf Act. And it was named after Bertram Baker, who was a black politician from Brooklyn, a state legislator. And, you know, this is one thing that my book really tries to show, that there were some important differences in race relations in the North and South. One of them was that African-Americans could vote, and they couldn't always win, you know, senatorial or gubernatorial elections, but they could often win local elections. And people like Bertram Baker got in the state legislature and began to pass open housing laws was one of the things that Baker pioneered.
Jason Sokol's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book, All Eyes Are Upon Us, is about race and politics in the northeastern United States in the civil rights era and slightly beyond as well. We talked a little bit about the Robinsons and the fact that they ended up trying to move to the suburbs,
right,
as a lot of the Brooklyn Dodgers fans did over the years as well. You mentioned Stamford, but not even as far away as Stamford from New York City. New Rochelle, New York, was called the Little Rock of the North. Why was that?
New Rochelle got that moniker because there was a famous lawsuit. Well, famous among me and my historian colleagues. There was actually an obscure lawsuit filed against the New Rochelle school system, alleging that there was segregation in the schools. And there was, because what you had in New Rochelle was a few schools that were pretty much all black, and the rest of the schools were pretty much all white. And it wasn't just by accident. It wasn't just that African Americans lived in a certain part of the city. It was also that the school committee had come up with ways to redistrict and rezone and transfer students to make sure that those black schools stayed black and the white schools stayed white. And those kinds of policies were instituted by school committees across the Northeast. I found evidence of similar things in Springfield, Mass. Certainly Boston School Committee did the same thing. That's why a judge finally ordered widespread school busing in Boston. So 1960, New Rochelle was the first city to gain prominence because of that kind of policy.
You mentioned Springfield again, and there were something called optional areas in Springfield schools. How were those supposed to work?
Well, these would be basically little parts of neighborhoods where the people living there could choose from a couple different schools. So they had the option of sending their kid to this school or that school. What I found in Springfield was that the optional areas were often streets or blocks where white families lived, but usually within the district of schools that were majority black. So it was a way for white families that were in these school districts to be able to send their kids to white schools.
And as often happened in the South, I know, you know, you get a lot of cases where the public schools are in some cities are predominantly African American or minority, and the white kids go to private schools. Did that end up happening in a lot of the northern cities too, like Springfield,
where the white kids went to private schools?
Right.
Yeah, it did. That probably happened a little later in the North, just because the mandates for school integration happened a little later.
And again, we're talking about Springfield, Massachusetts, not Springfield, Oregon. Jason Sokol from January 2015, talking about integration in the Northeast, far from Alabama and Mississippi. And All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn. You'll hear the rest of the interview here on The Exchange in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Historian Jason Sokol focuses his work on the civil rights movement and narrowed the focus to the northeastern United States in All Eyes Are Upon Us, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn. Discrimination, segregation, resistance to integration happened in North as well as South. The author visited 3 years ago, and back we go. Let me take a little aside here to step back for a broader perspective. I mean, you did primarily look at parts of New York City and the New York metro area and southern New England. Did you get a chance to get a sense for how different those areas might have been from the rest of the North?
Well, the reason that I focused on those areas is because I think that they thought of themselves as really the nation's beacon of democracy and freedom and equality, and a lot of other people perceive them as such. The difference, I think, you know, you could obviously argue that I should have included a place like Philadelphia, which has a long civil rights tradition and also an equally long tradition of racial segregation. So does Chicago, so does Detroit. So there are a lot of places outside of the South with long and fascinating histories of race and racism. What I thought is that those places didn't necessarily claim to be on interracial democracy's frontier or something like that. I think those cities had in a way didn't make that kind of boastful sort of comment about themselves. It's not to say that those places actually had any more success in dealing with the problems, but a lot of what I'm talking about at the beginning is the sort of the image and the perception that I'm playing off.
Which again, when we come back to Springfield, when the schools in Springfield, Massachusetts were taken to court to integrate, you get a real sense from the text of people in the white community reacting to, oh no, we don't do that sort of thing. That doesn't happen here.
Exactly. And they were, first of all, they were shocked, or they claimed to be shocked. And in the lawsuit that you mentioned, so this is a lawsuit that several black parents in Springfield filed a lawsuit against the school system saying that there was segregation. The NAACP represented the parents and waged the suit. And then in defense, the city's attorney used the line in his closing argument. He said, if we were segregationists, quote unquote, this was his argument, if we were segregationists, you know, we wouldn't have drawn the redistricting lines here. We would have just said black schools are here and white schools are here. You know, if we were segregationists, we would have just drew up a blatantly segregationist school system. But we're not segregationists, he said. You know, instead, we had every good intention. It just ended up this way.
Which gets you into a real zone of really forcing you to think about, well, what frame of reference do people start from, and how capable are they of expanding that frame of reference to take in what somebody else might be thinking?
Right. And a lot of the debates that we have today, I think, revolve around this idea of colorblindness, you know, whether people should take race into account when they are crafting policies, for instance. And in this case of the Springfield schools, the NAACP lawyer had a retort to the Springfield attorney, and this was a very prominent lawyer named Robert Carter, who was instrumental in the Brown versus Board decision. And Robert Carter said that, you know, you have to take race into account when the place you're dealing with is already thoroughly segregated. And a lot of the leaders in Springfield wanted to say that they were colorblind and that, you know, they didn't take race into account when they were crafting these kind of zoning policies. And Robert Carter says, well, if you don't take race into account, then you're just exceeding, you know, you're just allowing the current reality to prevail. And the current reality is a segregated one. So you have to take race into account if you want to ever bring about an integrated society.
Oh, a really interesting difference in approaches then. I mean, the white folks are coming from the, well, we took the laissez-faire approach. Things just happened this way. And what this lawyer from the NAACP is saying is, no, you have to really be activist about this.
Right. He's saying if you actually, you know, want to bring about a desegregated world, then you have to first admit that there's racial inequality and racial segregation. And then second, you have to do something about it. And the white leaders in Springfield wanted to just say that they could just be colorblind and that would be that.
Two key electoral figures here, elected public figures that you focus on, Ed Brooke and his Senate race in Massachusetts in 1966, and Shirley Chisholm running for Congress from Brooklyn 2 years later. Very different approaches here. Now, Ed Brooke ran for the Senate in Massachusetts when race relations were certainly heating up. Did he really bring race into it in any way?
Well, Brooke's strategy, at least when he was campaigning, his strategy was actually to play upon the white electorate's thinking that it was colorblind, you know, exactly the thing I was just talking about. So Brooke wanted to, you know, Brooke was an African American in a state that was 97% white. He was also a Republican in a state that was largely Democratic. He was a Protestant in a state that was largely Catholic. So he had all these sort of, on paper, he had all the stats going against him. But what he wanted to tell the electorate was that, you know, none of that mattered when they stepped into the voting booth. They should just pick the candidate who was best qualified and who would best represent their views. So he wanted to get them to come around. He wanted to get the electorate to come around to that sort of thinking. Of course, there was always the implicit, though. There was always the implicit message. Brooke's first bumper stickers said, "Proudly for Brooke." And, you know, what would the electorate be proud of? Well, presumably it would be proud that they elected the first African-American to the Senate since Reconstruction. So there was always that implicit wink and nod to nudge people to break that racial barrier.
That we're doing something different here by electing this guy.
Right. Yeah. And Brooke played upon Massachusetts' heritage, you know, as the home of the abolitionists, and tried to convince people that they were capable of looking beyond race, as he said, looking, you know, the irony was to look beyond race in order to elect the first black candidate.
And how different was Shirley Chisholm's race for the U.S. House 2 years later?
Well, the primary difference was Chisholm's terrain, where, you know, Brooke ran statewide in a state, as I said, that was almost all white. Well, Chisholm was running from this newly created congressional district in Brooklyn, and the heart of the district was Bedford-Stuyvesant, which had a large African-American population. And then there were also several other neighborhoods, though, that had very mixed populations. Jews in Williamsburg and Crown Heights, Puerto Ricans also in Williamsburg, sort of Italian-Americans, Polish Catholics. So Chisholm really, you know, the heart of her constituency were the African-Americans in Bedford-Stuyvesant, but she was running against another black candidate in the Democratic primary, and what set her apart from that candidate was her ability to win the votes from the other people in the district. So I argue that Chisholm was actually really a multiracial campaigner and that she built this multiracial and, in a way, multilingual coalition with the Puerto Ricans and Spanish speakers. And that's how she came to power.
She did not hold back either. She had already said she was not going to be a quiet freshman in Congress. And so what was her first speech on in the House?
Her first speech was actually about the Vietnam War. But, you know, what she said was that Nobody should support the Vietnam War as long as there's such abject poverty in the cities. So she, you know, made this direct connection between the legislation that we know as the Great Society and war on poverty and that stuff versus the Vietnam War. And she said, you know, as long as we're spending this many billions in Vietnam, we're not going to be spending it inside the country.
Jason Sokol's our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. His book about race relations in the Northeast is called All Eyes Are Upon Us. Abraham Ribicoff, a name that folks in Connecticut know well because he was governor, he was U.S. senator, gave a speech in the Senate in 1970 that's profiled in the book. What prompted it, and what did he end up saying?
Well, this story I found fascinating because it's really not one that I knew before starting the book, but What prompted Ribicoff's speech was the maneuvering of Senator John Stennis. And Stennis was a Mississippi, a longtime segregationist from Mississippi. And Stennis occupied his winter days by entering into the congressional record the school segregation statistics for northern cities. And so Stennis was saying the North is just as bad as the South, basically. And then Stennis proposed an amendment which said that the Senate would have to be uniform in its measures for integration across the country. So if it wanted to integrate schools in the South, it had to do the same thing everywhere in the country. And many senators saw this as just another Southern ploy to sort of get the South off the hook. That is, if northern senators had to enact widespread integration plans in the North, they would sort of ease up on the South because they didn't want that kind of widespread change in their own communities. Well, when Stennis offered this amendment, Abe Ribicoff in Connecticut saw an opening, and he supported the Stennis Amendment. And he said, yeah, the North should go ahead and integrate its own schools. We should have national integration plans. And he stood on the Senate floor, he gave a speech, and he said the North is guilty of monumental hypocrisy in its treatment of the black man.
Wow. And I noticed that some of the major responses came from newspapers in the South.
White Southerners immediately embraced Ribicoff as a hero. There's this one cartoon that I print in the book, and it's from the Richmond, Virginia newspaper. And the cartoon shows a statue of Ribicoff being built next to the statue of Robert E. Lee. So white Southerners said, here's a white Northerner who finally understands.
Wow, that's a really interesting set of circumstances. Let's take a call. Here's Mark in Redding, California. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Jason Sokol.
Yes, Senator Brooke had history in Massachusetts. He'd been the attorney general, and he was very strong on anti-mafia stuff, which may have had some effect on his campaign.
Yep.
And right. Yeah, I mean, I interviewed Brooke, and he told me that the most important election for him was not winning the Senate in 1966. It was becoming Attorney General in 1962. That was when he really broke through and won a statewide office. And then he was able to build up a record, and then the constituents, got to know him.
Mark, was there a further point you wanted to make?
Well, I have read that when Shirley Chisholm was in the Congress, she said that she noticed discrimination against her more as a woman than she did as a African-American.
Interesting. Okay, thanks for that, Mark. Appreciate it. Anything you had followed up with about that, Jason?
Well, that's true. I mean, Chisholm wrote that in an essay, and her slogan was unbought and unbossed. And the second part of that, unbossed, certainly had double meaning. It meant that she was not controlled by the political bosses on the one hand, and it meant that she was also not controlled by the men.
As the book goes on, you get it further into things that ultimately changed in the territory you're talking about here. But for example, having grown up, gone to high school about half an hour east of Hartford, I remember how often people would talk in hushed tones about the North End. That's where the black folks live, that sort of thing. It took forever for a city that had a large minority population to elect. Was it Thurman Milner? Was he the first black mayor there?
Right. Thurman Milner was the first black mayor in Hartford, elected in 1981, and he was also the first black mayor of any city in New England. And he didn't win that election until whites actually became a minority of the city's population.
Wow. And so for things like busing, I mean, did that finally reach a point where the schools in New England cities, in Boston in particular, got to some level of natural integration?
Well, you know, busing did bring a measure of integration to the schools. The problem was that white families continued to move out of the city. I mean, white flight had already begun long before busing, and busing only accelerated it. But yeah, busing brought a measure of integration to the city's schools, and that integration would not have been brought without that plan.
Does the racist streak still exist in New York and New England, you think? Is it less than it used to be? I mean, are people still race conscious, just as they seem to be in the rest of the country?
Oh, definitely. I mean, you can see that in the Eric Garner case. I mean, there is a total outcry, of course, in New York about the episodes of injustice against African Americans. I also try to point out that in terms of electoral politics, African Americans are doing better in the Northeast. Deval Patrick was governor for two terms in Massachusetts.
Yeah, much of the book we didn't even get to. All Eyes Are Upon Us is what it's called, Race and Politics from Boston to Brooklyn. Jason Sokol is the author. He's been our guest. Jason, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson Exchange.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.